Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we with us have us at the moment a very special guest. His name is Jim Mars. Jim, thank you so much for being with us. Jim, are you there?
Yeah, here we go.
Okay, fine. Well, we've been so hot out here on the West Coast, we've been having all sorts of problems with our equipment, but I think we probably pretty well got it going at the present time. So, anyway, Jim has written a book, of course, originally it was called The War on Freedom, but it's been republished now in advance and all sorts of new information in it, and it's called Inside Job. And would you like to tell a little bit about the background of how this book came to be written the way it is?
Well, sure. Basically, the day after 9/11, I wrote a piece and posted it on the Internet saying I totally agreed with President Bush that we had to find out who was responsible for that horrendous crime and punish him. But then I began to research, and I began to find out that there is more evidence leading back to the CIA and the U.S. government than there is leading to Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. So I began to put all of this information together because I'm a truth seeker. I simply wanted to know what really happened and who was really behind 9/11. And, of course, we're told it was Osama bin Laden and his Al-Qaeda terrorist network, which is fine, except what most people don't understand is you go past that, you find that they are both creations of our Central Intelligence Agency. And at a time when the president's father was both vice president and, of course, former head of the CIA. So all of a sudden, you find out that that there are other extenuating circumstances, such as the fact that there was a policy paper during the first Bush administration that called for deposing Saddam Hussein. This was issued after the Gulf War, and to invade Afghanistan, and to have a built-up military presence in the Middle East, etc. And you find this articulated in a 2000 position paper by the neoconservative think tank Project for a New American Century, which involves Dick Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Pearl, all of these prominent members of the Bush administration. So I think it behooves us to act like any good detective. Instead of taking the cover story, we should start considering who had the means, motives, and opportunities. Well, that led to the writing of The War on Freedom. And at one point, I had a contract with a major New York publisher. And yet, as they got ready to publish, even after passing the legal review, some official up there decided that the American people didn't need to hear all this stuff. It might upset someone. And in fact, the only reason I heard for... And so they canceled the book. And the only reason I ever heard was that they did not want to upset the families of 9/11 victims. Well, excuse me, I have met and talked with families of 9/11 victims, and these people, more than anyone else, want to know the truth of what happened to their loved ones. So I self-published The War on Freedom and sold out several printings, and I was still not reaching that national audience, so I went with Origin Press in California and their very brave publisher, Byron Belitzos, and he agreed to publish the book under the title Inside Job, because unfortunately that's where the evidence leads us. And Dr. Stan, I'll give you this one piece of information that to me proves it's an inside job. What the 9/11 Commission made very light of, they barely mentioned it, in fact I think they only mentioned it in a footnote, was that the North American Air Defense Command was conducting war game exercises the morning of September the 11th, 2001. This explains why FEMA's emergency management team arrived in New York City the night before the attacks. It also explains why, perhaps, that our military and intelligence and political chiefs were failed to react immediately upon that morning when the air traffic controllers began to report four airlines off course, probably hijacked, when the first plane flew into the North Tower of the World Trade Center. It is reasonable to assume that some of these people thought it was part of the war game exercises, because what we now know is at least one of the exercises was to have involved hijacked airplanes flying into buildings. Of course, we haven't been told this straight out, because that makes a total lie of what President Bush, Condoleezza Rice, and Dick Cheney have, and Rumsfeld have said repeatedly, which is, well, who would have ever imagined that they could have hijacked airplanes and flown them into buildings? And yet, we know for a fact that this plans for such activity was known as far back as 1995, when a Al-Qaeda cell in the Philippines was busted, and they found papers and computer documents showing their Operation Bojinka, which was to hijack commercial airliners and flying them to prominent buildings. So now they would be able to argue that the lack of proper response by our defense systems on 9/11 was due to the fact that the people were confused as to whether this was a real exercise or a war game exercise. But then, so you would think that they would have publicized this fact to help explain the lack of response. Instead, they have been very careful not to reveal all this. And why? Because once you understand that that's the case, the question naturally arises, how did the hijackers know how to coordinate their attack with the exercise?
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Jim Mars. And, of course, the other interesting thing is apparently the hijackers had the details of the special government codes for Air Force One, didn't they?
Exactly.
And now how would the hijackers get that sort of information?
It has to be an inside job. Somebody on the inside has to have passed along this information to them. And yet not only has there been no effort to find out who on the inside may have been behind the hijackers, but as I mentioned, there's even been an attempt not to reveal all of this to the public. Instead, they are expected to believe this little cover story that just 19 Muslims, just full of hatred for our freedom and democracy, hijacked airlines and just flew them into buildings and sacrificed themselves to Allah. Okay? Although there are news reports, valid, credible, documented news reports from Boston and other places, that these very same religious zealots, these devout Muslims who are prohibited from smoking or drinking or having extramarital affairs, were out in Boston the night before drinking heavily, smoking, and looking for hookers. It sounds more like mercenaries than Muslim fanatics. And this is only one of the many, many mysteries that have gone unanswered in the wake of the 9/11 Commission.
Well, you know, Jim, I think one of the things that's very interesting is that there is a lot of talk within the Muslim community. They were going to hijack planes, and they were going to hold in the passengers ransom to try to get the blind sheikh and Ramzi Yosef and others out of jail. It may very well have been that a lot of these people on the planes, the Arabs on the plane, didn't realize that they were going to be crashing them, that these were suicide missions.
Well, you know, Stan, it's interesting you say that, because if you'll recall, in the late fall of 2001, when the CIA came up with a tape recording that purported to be that of Osama bin Laden, and they tried to use that as the proof of his guilt, and yet from everything I saw, he was talking about this and that, but he never came out and said that he had anything to do with it. But what he did say was that the hijackers didn't know they were on a suicide mission, so apparently there is some legitimacy to that idea. And, of course, if they didn't know they were on a suicide mission, then what happened to those planes? And that brings us perhaps to the topic of Global Hawk, which is the capturing by electronics of modern jumbo jets and the control of them remotely from another destination, which is not science fiction. This is a technology that has existed since the late 70s and is in place on all the major Boeing jumbo jets. And it's simplistically, it's like a CB radio. If you have a CB radio and you're trying to talk to your friend and somebody comes within range that has a much more powerful radio, it will, what they call, step on the signal. It will override it, and you can't talk to your friend. You're only going to hear the person that has the stronger radio. Well, it works the same way with these electronic control devices. In fact, British Airways official early in 2000 said that the age of hijacking was over because from now on, if hijackers took over an airplane, they could electronically capture the control system of that airplane and guide it to a safe landing regardless of what the hijackers or even the flight crew wanted. So this is a technology that's in place. So that means all you had to do was get some hijackers to hijack some airplanes, and then the real perpetrators could guide them wherever they wanted them to go.
Well, you know, it's really very interesting that we know that nine of the hijackers were actually stopped on the morning of 9/11 because there was something suspicious about them, and yet, of course, they were still allowed to get onto the planes. These were people that were suspicious of, and yet they allow them to take on their box cutters and knives and who knows what else on. You would think if they were suspicious, they would have really checked them out.
Exactly.
And especially since the government knew that there was going to be a problem throughout the entire world. Everybody was on alert, except they sent out the directives to the FAA, and apparently the FAA never got the directives, the warning. You wonder why.
Well, you have to go back and understand how these things work. Let's go back to Pearl Harbor. A lot of people have compared 9/11 to Pearl Harbor, and it's a very apropos comparison, but not for the reason they think. They think, oh yeah, it was another dastardly sneak attack. Well, no, not really, because what we now know is that Roosevelt and George Marshall, a handful of others in Washington, knew precisely when and where Pearl Harbor was going to be attacked, and they held off, withheld that information. They withheld the Japanese decoding machine from the Pearl Harbor base. They even sent orders countermanding certain things. In other words, they stripped the normal security away from Hawaii to allow that to happen. We see the same thing happening in the Kennedy assassination. It was not so much who could have killed him. Anybody could have killed him. Castro agents, Russian agents, even yes, the proverbial lone nut. The question is, who had the power to strip away the normal security that protects the president? This was voiced many years ago by Colonel Fletcher Prouty, who was the liaison officer between the CIA and the Pentagon at the time. And he clearly saw that this was a case where the normal security was stripped away. So we have to ask ourselves on 9/11, who had the power to strip away the normal security? For example, in 1999, the golf pro, Payne Stewart, took off with some people in a Learjet. They had an oxygen malfunction. They all passed out or died. And the plane went off course and flew and flew and flew on autopilot. Within minutes, I mean minutes, like 12 to 15 minutes, something like that, they had jet interceptors all over that plane, and they followed it all day, and they were ready to shoot it down if it looked like it was going to crash into a populated area. But it didn't. It ended up running out of gas over in a not populated area, and it crashed, and that was about the end of that. But the point is, the security system acted rapidly and efficiently in the case of Payne Stewart, and yet on the morning of 9/11, with four commercial airliners off course and presumed hijacked, with even suspecting that there may have been more, there was just a systematic failure of our security system. And Dr. Stan, what really bothers me about this is, I mean, that's a statement of fact. That's not some theory. And yet, to this very day, not one person in the government has been fired, censored, reprimanded, anything. No action has been taken against anything. In fact, some of the officials, military officials and FAA officials who testified to the 9/11 Commission and given testimony, sworn testimony, that contradicts some of the statements of the 9/11 Commission report, have actually been promoted and moved on up into bigger and better jobs. So
one of the things you told in your book about the very day that they had the this 9/11 incidents, why they got the flight controllers together, and there were five or six of them, and they all gave a taped testimony. Do you remember that story?
Right.
They all recorded their testimony so that they would have an exact testimony of what happened that morning, so nobody would forget, and so nobody could get to them and get them and force them to alter their testimony. So what happened to that tape?
A ISA official destroyed it. Now, that's not the first instance of destruction of evidence. You know, here are the tapes of the air traffic controllers involved who were telling exactly what happened and in a precise time frame. And those tapes are destroyed.
Well, I think the thing that they waited until January. The fellow crushed the tape in his hand and then took the tape and cut it into small pieces and put it into various trash disposals in various parts of the building. Now, why would anybody do something like that unless they absolutely wanted to make sure nobody would have that? And if anybody doubts, we have the article out of the newspaper, I think the Wall Street Journal, that tells that story.
Right.
Why would anybody want to cover up the truth about what happened that day? Because when the flight controllers testified before the 911 commission, they weren't allowed to come in alone. Somebody had to be there monitoring them from the FAA to make sure they said what they were told to say.
Right, and keep in mind, they've had 3 years to coach everybody on what to say, you know. This was not like any other investigation in history. The day after Pearl Harbor, Congress convened a commission to investigate what happened at Pearl Harbor. Within a week of the Kennedy assassination, Lyndon Johnson created the Warren Commission, that great cover-up, but at least they had something they were doing. It was the Bush administration dragged their feet for almost 2 years.
And they did everything they could to block the commission hearings.
That's right.
And then, well, the only reason they would allow the 911 commission is because they got the chance to appoint not only who was there, but to lay out the rules and regulations and then to censor the report afterwards. If there's nothing to conceal, why was the Bush administration so interested in concealing it?
Exactly. And then let's take a look at who they finally got. If you'll remember, President Bush's first choice to head the 9/11 Commission was none other than Henry Kissinger, the very person who's probably been the architect of our foreign policy for the past 35 years or so, and probably created the very situation that caused these attacks on 9/11. You know, it's kind of like putting a fox in charge of a hen house. And in fact, that seemed to be so blatant that he quickly withdrew his name, particularly when he said that he would learn that he would have to produce his client list for Kissinger and Associates, which would have included the Saudi Arabians and many other Arab nations. And so they turned to Thomas Kern, the former governor of New Jersey, okay? Well, and then Lee Hamilton was his co-chair, okay? And both of them, members of the Council on Foreign Relations, the secret society that tries to run everything. And Keene, by the way, sits as a member of the board of directors of Amerada Hess, one of the largest oil companies there is, so he's got a big vested interest in oil. These people are not disinterested judges.
Everybody on that commission had some connection. I mean, Janie Korolec had been on the in the Justice Department. She was the one who created the wall that would keep the FBI agents from talking to one another.
Right.
I mean, you go down the list of those people, not one of them should have been on that commission.
No, they should have been sworn in as witnesses.
Right. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening, Jim Mars. We're talking about his book, Inside Job. So why don't you pick up the story from there, Jim?
Well, when this book came out, I think one of the great ironies was that since my book with the HarperCollins was canceled because they didn't want to upset the families of 9/11, I think it was great irony that my book, Inside Job, has a foreword written by Ellen Mariani, the widow of a 9/11 victim, who is involved in a suit against the federal government and says that Bush and others failed to stop this, that they probably had every reason to know that it was going to happen, and yet they allowed it to happen.
And I think what's so interesting about her, Jim, is they paid off all the family members.
Yes.
They gave them large sums of money, between $500,000 and $2.5 million, with the idea that they would not bring any suits. And the inference was that they would not ask any more questions. They would just be quiet and go away. Now, when in all recorded history has the government given large sums of money to the victims of a catastrophe?
Exactly.
And yet, of course, this was a cover-up. At Mary, Miss Mariani refused to take the money because she said, "I want to get to the truth of what really happened to my husband."
Exactly.
And what, you know, what this was really all about. And there are just only a very, very few people who did not take the money. After all, when they're going to give you $1 million or $1.5 million, it's pretty hard to turn it down. But ladies and gentlemen, it was simply a payoff to get the people to be quiet. Now, if there's nothing to conceal, why are they paying off the people? Because there's no other explanation. They didn't give large sums of money to the people in the Oklahoma City bombing.
Nope.
But why the World Trade Center?
They didn't give any money to the victims of the Waco destruction.
Right.
Well, Dr. Stan, let me tell you, here's what I find interesting. Did you see the piece just last week that, Ellen Mariani and many of the other 9/11 victims' families feel very strongly that somebody within the government knew more than what they're telling, and that they allowed this to happen for their own political purposes? And just last week, there was a poll by Zogby International that showed that half the people in New York City apparently believe that very thing. They support the idea that 9/11 was an inside job. But of course, they were there. They heard the stories. They've heard from the relatives of firemen who said, yeah, there were bombs in the buildings. They know a 47-story steel and glass building doesn't just suddenly collapse on itself from a little fire somewhere. They know these things, but outside of New York and all throughout this great country, of course, we're all, at the mercy of the major media, who's going to tell us not only what to think about, but how to think about it.
Or they're going to so confuse us that we really can't perceive what's going on. And one of the things that you did in your book, you pointed out all the evidence that is there that points directly to the Mossad being involved. And then you pointed out all the evidence that's involved that points to the fact it was really the Pakistanis.
Right.
And then you point out to all the evidence that shows it definitely was the Saudi Arabians. And, of course, maybe when we bring our stations back, why we can talk about this one fascinating bet that came out of Russia by one of the chief economists there, who announced there was going to be an attack ahead of time, told people to get the Russian people to get their investments out of the United States. And, of course, she didn't believe after the attack that this was carried out by 19 hijackers at all. But I'm going to let you tell that story in just a moment here, as soon as our other stations return, right online here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we were just talking, and Jim was in his book. You'll find it's a fascinating book, a great read, and so much information you're not going to find elsewhere. And he simply points out that there's a great deal of information that shows the Mossad was behind this. But there's equally convincing information that shows the Pakistanis were behind this. And then, of course, as you read further, you find out that, obviously, the Saudis were behind this. And what you're finding is they're just overloading us with faulty information. And then, of course, there's always the possibility it was the CIA and the FBI and key peoples in government. But what was it this woman, this economist, this chief economist from Russia had said beforehand and then after the 9/11 attack?
Well, Dr. Tanyana Kurajina is a senior research fellow for the Institute of Macroeconomic Research under the Russian Ministry of Economic Development, and reportedly very close to President Putin. And in August, late August of 2001, Pravda published a story in July of 2001, where she predicted that an unusual catastrophe would strike the United States in late autumn. August 2001. She was off by a couple of weeks. And she said the U.S. has been chosen as the object of a financial attack because the financial center of the planet is located there. The effects will be maximal. The strike waves of economic crisis will spread over the planet instantly. and remind us of the blast of the huge nuclear bomb. Later, she said, asked about the discrepancies in her date. She said, well, I did not make a serious mistake. Indeed, between 15th and 20th of August, the dollar started trembling under the pressure of multiple bad news about the U.S. economy, and within weeks, the Manhattan skyscrapers fell down. What's really interesting, Dr. Stan, is that she not only predicted that something like this was going to happen, indicate, but this only reflects what I carefully document in my book, Inside Job, which is there were warnings coming from all over the world that something like this was going to happen. We had the warnings coming from the Philippines in the 90s. We had the strike by bin Laden on the coal. We had all this stuff that was going on. The FBI, even the 9/11 Commission report was forced to call the summer of 2001, said the alarm system was flashing red. Everybody from China, Russia, even the Taliban in Afghanistan tried to warn American authorities that we were about to be the victim of a massive terrorist attack. Okay? Did it reach some of the upper levels? It most certainly did, because in August of 2001, Attorney General John Ashcroft announced that he was going to quit flying commercial airliners and would only take government chartered planes. Likewise, Pentagon officials suddenly, it became known and was reported in the media that they too had quit flying commercial jetliners and would only fly in government chartered, special chartered planes. Wouldn't it have been nice if they had warned the rest of us?
Yes, and of course we know that Willie Brown was notified the night before. The people in the Defense Department were warned the day beforehand. The story is told that the children in the Pakistani section of New York, adjacent to the 911 towers, these World Trade Center towers, they brought cameras to school that day so they could film the attack on the World Trade Center, and yet we're supposed to believe that the FBI had no idea what was going to happen.
Oh, this is just hogwash. Let me give you a personal example here. A very personal friend of mine, Stan, flew into New York that morning and got there about 8 o'clock, okay, an hour or so before the attacks. And he said the first thing that struck him as really odd is he couldn't seem to find a taxi cab. Well, you know, you've been to New York. I mean, you find a taxi cab everywhere. And it took him some time to get a taxi cab. And when he finally got one, he said, where are all the taxi cabs? And the driver told him that all the Arab taxi cab drivers in New York City had called in sick that morning.
And, of course, but the FBI had no idea.
But the FBI doesn't know anything.
And if you believe that, why, you probably,
Dr. Stan, look, I look at this, I try to break things down into simplistics, okay? It's either or. And in this case, either the FBI truly did not know that anything was going to happen, in which case, we need to fire the bunch of them, get somebody who will figure out what's going on, or they did know and didn't do anything about it, in which case they're criminal murderers and something should be done to them, too.
Well, of course, I know. We've always told they couldn't connect the dots. I know they connected the dots. I actually contacted the head of the flight school in Norman, Oklahoma, who told me 10 days before the attack they were there checking on Zacharias Moussaoui, and you're being told by the 911 Commission report, oh, if they'd just been able to put Moussaoui together with the Phoenix Memorandum, everything would have been fine.
Right.
They knew exactly what was going on.
Of course.
But they can't admit this to the American people
they can't admit it's an inside job.
Right. We're going to be right back. And this is a great book, Inside Job. And we'll tell you a little later how to get it. It's a must reading. Anybody wants to know what really happened that morning. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Jim Mars. His book is Inside Job and must reading. It's just off the press. And this is part of what was in his previous book, which was War and Freedom. But it's updated, much more recent information that wasn't in there. And one of the stories I'd like you to tell is one you brought to my attention and I've used many times, and that is Norman Mineta's testimony before the 911 commission. Now, it's not in his written statement. It's when they were just asking him casually. They had no idea what he was going to say. I think they thought they knew what he was going to say because they wouldn't let anybody testify unless they knew ahead of time, because the last thing they wanted was to get the truth on the record.
That's right. But I think something slipped out here.
Well, why didn't you tell that incredible story?
Well, Norman Mineta was the transportation secretary, of course, and he said that on the morning of 9/11, he rushed to the White House command center and that Dick Cheney was there. And he said while he was there and being horrified along with everybody else with the planes crashing into the World Trade Center, they announced, and of course I clearly remember this too, that they said there was a third plane out there that they were trying to find, and they had reason to believe it was heading towards Washington. And he said that a young man came in to Cheney and kept saying the plane is 50 miles out. He came back in, he said the plane is 30 miles out. He came back in, he said the plane's 20 miles out. And at that point he said, do the orders still stand? And Mineta testified that Cheney, in kind of an angry voice, said, well, what makes you think the orders don't stand? And so the young man says, yes, sir, and runs off. And a few minutes later, something struck the Pentagon, okay, killing a number of people, causing severe damage to the West Wall. Now, the question is, of course, if they knew all about this plane and they knew it was coming in, where were the fighter interceptors? And if they were all away on the war games, why didn't they tell us that? And if they were out of position, how come they didn't activate the missile batteries at Ring Washington?
And that is, of course, the big question that nobody wants to ask. They have missile batteries all over Washington, D.C. to protect the Pentagon, to protect the city. So why weren't those missile batteries mobilized, and why doesn't anybody talk about that?
Exactly. And they cannot argue that we didn't know where the plane was and we didn't know where it was coming or anything else, because according to Norman Mineta, they were tracking it from more than 50 miles out.
And what's the incredible part of the story is not one bit of the major media picked that up. The members of the 9-1 Commission, somebody said, well, what were the orders? And Mineta said, I don't know. And they never wanted to get back to that question.
They never went back to
ask yourself why, if they were tracking the plane, why haven't they told us that?
That's right.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Jim Mars. And we're talking about his book, Inside Job, and this is must reading. We're going to carry the book. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. You want to get this book, you want to get our interviews with Jim Mars as well, because it's going to give you information you're just not going to get elsewhere. I wonder how many of you out in the listening audience have heard about those missile batteries that were there. Of course there were missile batteries there, because you don't really believe that the capital of the United States is going to be left completely unprotected. Or we're told, well, we have these planes, but they were going to intercept planes coming from Russia or from Europe or something. We never anticipated anything happening in the United States. One of the most incredible things is when they took the planes out of Langley. These were, I think, I don't know, F-16s or something like that, F-15s. Anyway, they can go 1,800 miles an hour. And so they're 105 miles away from Washington, D.C., so they send them out over the Atlantic Ocean. And then at the time that the Pentagon is hit, they're 150 miles away from Washington, D.C. What's wrong with this story?
Again, it's an either-or situation. Either it was just total incompetence, in which case we need to fire the lot of them, get somebody that is competent, or it was worse than incompetent, it was a conspiracy, in which case we really better find out about that.
And, of course, when the president, is told that America is under attack, then he spends another 6 or 7 minutes talking about the story of the goats. And apparently, Ari Fischer, Fleischer,
yeah,
was asked about that, and he said, well, it was only really a matter of a second. But it was a lot longer than a second.
It was more like 15 minutes or
right.
more. And, you know, that's pretty, that thing bothers me too. Bush has tried to explain his lack of response by claiming that he did not want to scare the school children. You know, I mean, he didn't want to jump up and scream, "Oh my God, we're under attack, we're all going to die." Well, you know, I understand that. But explain to me why the president in a schoolroom of grade schoolers couldn't simply stand up and say, "Kids, I'm sorry, but something has come up, some president business, and I have to take care of it," and walk out of the room.
I think he was scared to death. I think that he probably did not know exactly what was going to happen, because with any operation, they never tell the president. They have to give him plausible deniability. That's what Admiral Poindexter said about the Iran-Contra deal. He said President Reagan would love to have known what we were doing, but we never told him. Because that way he wasn't held responsible.
That's right. Then he could legitimately say, "I don't know."
And I really believe that's true. I think that he was manifested that. I think he was scared to death when he realized what had happened. And that's why he sat there trying to collect his thoughts and, "What am I going to do? I mean, this, we've known something was going to happen, but it's happened, and I'm supposed to take command, but it's a lot easier to sit there and talk about the goats than to get to his feet and take leadership, because he never really has run the country. He's always really been run by Dick Cheney, and
exactly.
He is simply the figurehead for the establishment, in my estimation. Exactly. What do you think, Jim?
I totally agree. I've always said that President Bush is a post-turtle. Okay, now, post-turtle, that's a familiar term down here in rural Texas. You drive along the road and you see where some scallywags have placed a poor turtle up on a fence post, and he's just up there balancing on top of the post. Well, you know right away that he didn't get up there by himself. You know somebody put him up to it. You know he can't accomplish anything while he's up there, and all you really want to do is just help that poor creature down. So he's a post turtle. But let me tell you something, Dr. Stan, the devil is in the details and in the circumstances that cannot be changed, phonied, or altered, okay? And what I'm talking about here is that we know that the Pentagon received a call that morning, in a radio message in that day's top secret security codes, and it said Air Force One is next. So in other words, they had every reason to believe that this terrorist attack was not only aimed at America in general, but President Bush in particular, and possibly even Air Force One. And yet he simply sat in a schoolroom, you know, with this knowledge. And then when he finally left, they hustled him out. He got back in his car, and he drove the same motorcade route that had been publicized there in Florida for several days. And they went back to Air Force One, and it took off without any kind of fighter escort. Now, that doesn't sound to me like the actions of someone who thinks that Air Force One is in true danger.
But I don't think the president has any control over any of this. This is all planned by the aides around him. And obviously they didn't think there was any danger to the president.
Or maybe they knew there wasn't any.
Maybe they knew there was no danger. Maybe they knew what they can't let the American people know. And that is that there was a great many people who knew there was going to be an attack that morning.
Right.
I mean, most of the taxi drivers in New York called in sick. If the Pakistani, anybody wants to read that, did you include that in your book about the Pakistani children and the cameras?
There was an account in my book, Inside Job, about the five Israelis that were on the rooftop in New Jersey filming the disaster at the World Trade Center, and apparently jumping up and down. They were real excited, acted like they were enjoying it all, and they actually were picked up and arrested, and it turns out they were Israelis. In fact, it turns out, and later they were all deported, and apparently they were connected with more than 200 Israelis who, over the year 2002, were expelled from this country for being part of what came to be known as the art student spy ring. And of course, most people didn't hear anything about that because they were Israelis. But you can just imagine what kind of hoorah there would have been if it turned out to be a 200-man Iraqi spy ring.
Okay, so there were many, many things. And of course, they obviously knew the attack was coming. They were there. There were the cameras. But then the Mossad had actually warned the Americans that the attack was coming. They knew the attack was coming. They told America the attack was coming. And our leaders said, "Oh, well, no, we don't think anybody's right. We don't care what the Moroccans have told us, and the Jordanians have told us, and the Germans have told us, and the Mossad has told us, and what Putin has told us. No, we think the attack is going to be overseas." And I don't believe that at all, because somebody called Mayor Willie Brown the night beforehand.
That's
and
right.
I checked that story out, and I know you have as well. So the information is all there. The articles are in Newsweek magazine on the 24th of November, pointing out that high Defense Department officials canceled their flights for the 11th of September on the 10th of September, and Newsweek magazine wouldn't talk to my friend Dr. Dennis Cuddy when he called him and asked him about that story, and they said, we don't want to talk about it. Well, I can understand
how
that
would. How's that for freedom of the press?
Right.
They have the freedom to tell you, we're not going to talk about this story.
Well, I think that there's so much information in your book, and I think really what's so fascinating to me was the realization that they planted all sorts of stories to confuse us.
Oh, yeah.
And why don't you tell the story of the passports? Because I think
that's
so
incredible.
Oh, that's
one of my favorites. Yeah, that one was so paper thin that they quit telling that story pretty quick. But the idea is that they claim to have found one of the hijackers' paper passport lying in the street of New York City somewhere, okay? So they made a big deal of that for a day or two, and then it just kind of dropped from sight, and they haven't mentioned that much anymore. And I don't think the 9/11 Commission made mention of that either, because all of a sudden any thinking person goes, now, wait a minute. They tell us they can't get any use out of those steel black boxes that they designed to withstand airplane crashes and fires and everything else to give the last second readings of what happened to that plane, and they're all useless. We can't do that because it just got destroyed, but this paper passport somehow survived and fluttered down to the street. I mean, it's just such a ridiculous idea that they kind of dropped that story pretty quick. But it was there. Dr. Stan, you recall it, I'm sure.
Oh, I do. And, in fact, actually, in the staff report of the 911 Commission, and any of our listeners out there like the pages, I have them, and they're actually referenced in my last newsletter, the exact page. The staff report actually told that story, and it wasn't just one passport. There was another passport up there in Pennsylvania that of course, that one is a little singed, but that was another one of the passports. Now, what are the chances that those two passports would survive and nothing else survived, you know? Or were they trying to convince us that those Arabs were on the planes? But they had to know then who the Arabs were going to be if they had the passports already there planted ahead, you know, to plant immediately. So, you know, this is so obvious that if we find them in one lie, then everything else is a lie.
Well, and I'll tell you something else, having gone through that 9/11 Commission report, and I am so struck by the similarities with the Warren Commission report, you know, which came out about this same time of year in 1964, exactly 40 years ago. And here, 40 years later, we have the 9/11 Commission report. I think it was actually issued in late July, and I think the Warren Commission was issued towards the end of September, but it's almost the same time here. And the similarities are really striking. Number one, neither one of these reports has an index. So it's really difficult to try to, you know, you see one name one place and you say, now, wait a minute, didn't I see it somewhere else? But you can't go use an index to move around in the thing to go back and find the people and the issues that you want to try to correlate. So that makes it difficult to kind of put it all together. What you have to do, of course, is just read it from start to finish. And then you find that there's page and page and page after page of just real slow, turgid reading, you know, just having to do with recitation of government agency policies. And in other words, all of this extraneous stuff, just like the Warren Commission, you know, they had page and page of analyst analyses of hair, and spent several pages talking to a woman who never even knew Oswald, you know, just real extraneous, inconsequential things. And the 9/11 Commission report is the exact same thing. And then you try to find stuff like the passport, it's not even in there. You try to find, you know, you go back and look at the sworn testimony, and you'll find that it is sometimes contradicts what they put in their report. And so this is just, to me, very obviously a whitewash, particularly when you consider, as we've already talked about, the people and the associations of the people who were involved. They only told us what they wanted us to know. And I think this is just terrible, because having gone through the whole Kennedy assassination thing, I don't want to wait another 40 years to find out what happened on 9/11, particularly in light of the fact that the government and the Bush administration in particular are using 9/11 as the basis for just almost every policy and every activity they've taken. We attacked another country. We attacked Afghanistan because we were told that Osama bin Laden was behind the attacks and he was probably hiding there. Well, there's been no solid evidence to show that he was even behind the attacks. And I'm not saying he wasn't, because he may have been. But I'm saying the evidence against him is paper thin and probably could be torn apart in any court of law by a competent defense attorney. I'm also saying that we hadn't found him in Afghanistan, so then we turned and attacked Iraq with Condoleezza Rice and Dick Cheney just constantly telling us that Osama bin Laden, I mean that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11. But he didn't. And even President Bush was finally forced to admit earlier this year that no, there was really, we didn't have nothing that showed he had anything to do with 9/11. So, you know, all this stuff is falsified information, bogus information, and yet it's all based on the idea that we were attacked on 9/11. So I think that it's incumbent upon us to find out who truly was behind the attacks of 9/11.
Well, let's get a little up into the shorting of the stock of American Airlines, United Airlines, J.P. Morgan, and other companies that had headquarters in the 911 buildings, in the World Trade Center buildings. Now, ordinarily, the CIA is constantly monitoring anything that's happening in the financial markets. If somebody's shorting large blocks of stock, they obviously know that they're going to fall. And these were very, very significant shorts, not only in Europe, but here in the United States. What was that all about, and what did the government come up saying? And what's the truth?
The 9/11 Commission, in a moment maybe of rare truth, said that the financial dealings with the terrorists and everything remain, quote, murky. Okay? It's murky. They can't seem to find out anything. We were told, of course, in the days following 9/11 that it was obvious that there was this short selling of stock that would have made somebody millions as stock in these airlines and their insurance carriers dropped. And they said we were going to get the FBI to investigate and see if that didn't track to Osama bin Laden. Well, then you never heard any more about it. And that's because it did not track to Osama bin Laden. It tracked back to Deutsche Bank and through Brown Harriman, a large investment firm, to some people who are connected with our Central Intelligence Agency.
And certainly Michael Rupert has got that all up on his webpage.
Exactly.
And the ties to the Central Intelligence Agency. But we can't let the American people know that. Think of the implications.
I know.
Those people were left to die.
And again, I've seen the same thing in the Kennedy assassination. There was, in the late 70s, there was an air conditioning repairman, man in Dallas who was on the roof of the county courts building who found a .30-06 shell casing, heavily weathered, had been there for a number of years. Now, why would there be a .30-06 shell casing on the roof overlooking Dealey Plaza? So he takes it, being a good citizen, to the FBI. The FBI says, well, this is a .30-06, and Oswald only had a 6.5-millimeter rifle, so this ain't got to do anything with anything. Take it away. Okay? That's the mentality. They don't want to hear any evidence other than what their official story is, and it's the exact same thing here. Once they thought they could track this to Osama, it fit the official account, so that was fine. And once they found out that it tracked to the CIA, instead of having a real investigation, and let's say, okay, now who in there knew about it? And for the 9/11 Commission to say that the financing of Al-Qaeda and Osama remains murky, it, to me, is pretty incredible, because anybody knows anything about the modern world today, especially in banking, they everything's in the computer. You know, every dime that comes in is accounted for. You know where it came from. You know where it went, how it went, and where it's going. And if they wanted truly to find out who is financing the terrorists, if they wanted truly to find out who is financing the drug lords and who's benefiting from the flow of drug money through the banking system, they could find out overnight and put a stop to all that. But they not, and they won't, because they don't want to do that. It finances the system as it is, and the system, you know, has to protect itself.
And I think that one of the interesting things is here, 15 of the 19 hijackers are from Saudi Arabia. The FBI allows not only all the members of the Saudi family and many of the rich Saudis, but the Bin Laden family, large numbers, I think 30 members of the Bin Laden family, to leave immediately after the 911 attack without really being held or questioned. And even Osama Bin Laden's brother-in-law, who's one of the largest financiers of Al-Qaeda, is allowed to leave America right after 911.
That's right.
And, of course, you have to ask yourself, why wouldn't they want to keep them and question them, to find out what they might know about the murder of 3,000 Americans?
Well, Dr. Stan, the answer that presents itself is because the whole thing is a sham, and it's an inside job, and we better start looking to domestic enemies.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to have just one short segment here when we get back. Give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you have a question. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess this evening, Jim Mars, and of course his book, Inside Job, is must reading for anybody who wants to really understand what happened that day, because Jim has some of the most amazing information that he's compiled and put together in this excellent, excellent book, which we certainly are going to be carrying, because we think it's important that the American people understand what transpired that day. Well, Jim, what were some of the other really important things that you covered? Because there are really so many details there.
Oh, yes, there's so much. But I'll tell you what I consider to be a real smoking gun is the capture of Abu Zubaydah, who, interestingly enough, plays a pretty prominent role in the narrative of the 9/11 Commission report as being one of the key players in the Al-Qaeda terror network. And yet, as far as I could tell, there was no mention of his arrest in Pakistan about a year ago, and of the fact that in a book published by a man with known connections to the CIA, we are told that he revealed to his captors that he was actually working for three Saudi princes through an air marshal in Pakistan. And of course, the Pakistani ISI for a long time has been rumored and reported to have been in the pocket of our CIA. And of course, who are the longtime close friends, business and social friends to the Saudis, both the royal family of Saud and the Bin Laden family, but the Bush family? This is not some speculation. That's absolute fact. It could be proven. In fact, according to court records and business records down here in Texas, George W. Bush got the money to start his first oil company, or Busto Energy in Houston, from Salim Bin Laden, Osama Bin Laden's older brother. That's how tight these families were.
Well, let's just take Matt here. I think he has a call. Matt, do you have a quick question?
Yes, I do.
Okay, fine. Let's get the question. You'll have to take it on the air. Go ahead.
Well, actually, too, the debris field of the crash in Pennsylvania matches one of a jet that was blown out of the sky. Number two, there were advanced warnings to Israeli businessmen to stay out of the 911 buildings.
All right, let's get those just thoughts on that.
Yeah.
And so let's go ahead. What about the shooting down of Flight 93?
Well, let me back into that. First off, yes, the advanced warning to the Israelis is covered in my book, Inside Job, and that's correct, sir. And as far as the crash in Pennsylvania, I think I may have some new information for you. I was under the impression for a good long time that that flight was most probably shot down.
Hold that thought for just a moment here.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we were just talking briefly about the Flight 93 that went down in Pennsylvania, and there are a lot of unanswered questions as to if this plane just crashed into the ground, why is the debris field out over an 8 mile circumference? If the plane went down, how did one of the motors get, a mile or so away? Anyway, what have you found, Jim?
Right. Well, you hit the key thing there. That plane obviously was not flown into the ground. That plane was coming to part in midair. So for the longest time, I was under the suspicion that it was shot down. Number one, they had already issued a shoot-down order, okay, and that was understandable. And there was an F-16 fighter jet in the area at the time, and considering that mile-long debris trail, to me it was obvious that the plane was coming apart in midair. However, I have now learned that the fighter pilot has been interviewed for a friend of mine who has an aviation magazine, and he revealed that, yes, he was on a training mission and that there were war game exercises going on, and he only had training ammunition and no missiles, which means that that plane could, and he said that he seriously contemplated kamikazing his plane jet into the liner to stop it, you know, but he said before he had to come to that decision, the plane just dropped from the sky. And then we have some unconfirmed reports that that they heard that something had hit the plane, okay, or there was an explosion on the plane. And then what we're now finding out, and the 9/11 Commission also brought this up, is that because of some of the phone calls from passengers on Flight 93 and from what was overheard from the cockpit, apparently they were telling them, the hijackers were saying, that there was a bomb on board. So considering the fact that the F-16 could not have shot down the plane, even if it wanted to, because they only had training ammunition, and the fact that the terrorists are reported saying we have a bomb, my suspicion now is that, yes, the passengers on Flight 93 made an attempt to regain control of the plane. I think they were successful, and one of the hijackers detonated a bomb.
Okay, what about the white jet, the stories of the white jet?
That possibly could have been the F-16.
All right, fine. Well, we're out of time, Jim. Thank you so very much. I really appreciate you being with us. We're looking forward to having you on our program, several other programs, several times this week, to get our people up to speed on what's going on. Thanks so much for being with us.
Okay. Always good to be with you,
good
Dr.
Night.
Stan.
Good night. Okay, fine. That was Jim Mars' book, of course, Inside Job, and it's available for Radio Liberty. We hope many of you will want to get it. Give us a call of 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like more information, and then, of course, we want to suggest that perhaps you'd like to get some of the material that we have on this story. You can go to my website of RadioLiberty.com and pull down all of my newsletters that are there. We, of course, have my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, which takes you behind the scenes who really runs the world. Unless you understand that there are not only people of great wealth working behind the scenes, but strong occultic forces that motivate and energize these people. And this is how you're able, of course, to come up and conceal so very much evidence. And there have been people out there who tried to get the information out, and, of course, they were not called to testify before the 911 Commission. Or if they did testify, they testified in secret, and they have sealed that information for 30 years. All this testimony that was not public will be sealed for 30 years. If there's nothing to hide, why are they hiding it? Well, this is the time to pray for America, because America has turned its back on God, and I really believe God is going to bring his vengeance onto this country, just as he did upon the people of Jericho, because they, too, had turned their back on God and were sacrificing the children of Moloch, just as we're sacrificing 40 million of our children to the gods of Moloch. Pray for America. Pray for revival. And, of course, remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Remember our number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And so until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But please hold your calls, because right now we have with us Rodney Stitz, and he is the author of a number of books we carry: Drugging America, Defrauding America, The Unfriendly Skies, and of course all of these get into the fact that there is corruption at the highest levels of our government. The Unfriendly Skies is the story of Rodney's effort to bring out the fact that the airlines, specifically United Airlines, was not following through with government requirements, and of course with the negligence on the part of United Airlines was responsible for a number of crashes with a number of people killed. And his efforts then to try to get the truth out was blocked at every turn, not only by the FAA, but by the court system itself. And so he is still in the process of trying to get that information out, not only his own information, but that of other people who have worked with the FAA, try to show the corruption in the organization. And then, of course, his book, Defrauding America, goes into the CIA and drug smuggling. Drugging America goes into the largest drug smuggler in the world, the American Central Intelligence Agency. And people say that can't be true. Well, of course it's true. If you read the CIA's own report on that, they actually had a GAO report on that. It's up on Mike Rupert's webpage. We actually pull that down. Had the CIA's own report admitting that the involvement of the CIA in drugs, but of course this would never be admitted by the media, and so the average individual has no idea that who is really funding the CIA. Your friendly drug smugglers throughout the world. Rodney, thank you so much for being with us.
Yes, good evening, Sam.
Well, why don't you tell us what are the latest things that are happening? I know that you have actually trying to get your suit into New York so that you can report to the court system about the corruption within government, and they really don't want to hear about it, do they?
Right. Yes. You know, over a period of years, the corruption that I first discovered was in the government's aviation safety offices, and especially after the government gave me the assignment to correct the conditions that were at that time causing the worst series of air disasters in the nation's history. And this is where I first started discovering the deep-seated corruption in certain government offices, safety offices. But over a period of years, as I started publishing books and appearing on radio and television shows, which started in 1978, many other government agents came to me, and these are FBI, CIA, and others, and they started providing me with information on corruption in other government offices. And these are matters that are gravely affecting the American people. It affects national security, and many people have died, especially in the aviation areas, as a result of these. So I first started bringing this information to members of Congress, offering to provide evidence, and they didn't want to hear it. I went to the various offices of the Department of Justice, and that was simply another cover-up.
Hold that thought for just a moment. We'll be right back here with Rodney Stitz, author of Defrauding America, Drugging America, and Unfriendly Skies. All right, Rodney. Well, why don't you pick up the story? Of course, for people who don't know Rodney, he is actually was one of the chief accident investigators for the FAA for many years. He's been a pilot that flown planes for many years. And eventually, he decided he was going to get a job working for the government. And, of course, he was going to, be able to investigate the crashes, and he did. But when he found a total corruption and cover-up and nothing being done to correct the various deficiencies, because he knew there was going to be other attacks, so he tries to report it to the Justice Department. He tries to report this to various departments of government, and nobody wants to hear about the corruption because, of course, everything in government is just cover-up. So go ahead and tell the story, Rodney.
First of all, let me mention the FAA in those days was smaller, and the number of airlines was much smaller. So one inspector could have responsibility, like I had the responsibility over the major programs at United Airlines. Now, when you have people in your immediate area of responsibilities being cremated alive and dismembered alive and preventable air disasters, and due to the corruption that exists, well, you get motivated to do something. Well, one of the things I finally did, since I was running into cover-ups all over the place, there's a particular federal statute. The wording is very clear, but virtually no one knows about it. And this is the Federal Crime Reporting Statute. It's Title 18, U.S.C. Section 4. And what it says in clear language is that anybody who knows of a federal crime must report it to a federal judge or other federal officer. So I thought, well, okay, I'm running into a block everywhere else. I'll report it to a federal judge, and a federal judge must receive it as part of his administrative duties. Well, anyhow, the first few actions I filed was in the U.S. District Court in San Francisco, and they were primarily against the FAA and the National Transportation Safety Board. Well, the first two court judge, Sanaki, if I remember, that was the first one, and then during oral arguments before the Court of Appeals, judges admitted to during the hearing that these are serious allegations, but that this is a matter for Congress to investigate. Well, I wasn't trying to get the courts to investigate it. I just wanted to report it and make a record of it. But anyhow, matter of fact, even one of the assistant U.S. attorneys...
Hold that thought for just a minute. So Rodney, of course, tries to report the malfeasance he's finding in the FAA to various government defense agencies. They won't accept it, but there is a law that says that if you know of a federal crime, you have to report it to a judge. So he tries to report it to the judges, and the judges admit there may be a crime, but they're saying, well, we don't want to hear about that. Congress is going to have to investigate it, and that isn't what the law says. The law says the federal judge has to take and record the report, and what he does with it is up to him. But, of course, Rodney is just trying to get the judge to accept his report that there are major crimes being involved with the FAA and their handling of flights, and they're letting the various airline companies, in this instance United Airlines, and we're talking about, 10, 20 years ago now?
Yes, it was some years ago, but the deep-seated problems within the FAA, even though that we don't have the crashes today we had then, but the deep-seated problems still exist. And this is where the hijackings of four airliners in 9/11 comes in. And that was one of the issues I brought up to the federal courts in New York City. Now,
First of all, let's get back to San Francisco. You filed the cases in San Francisco. The judges admitted that your charges are serious, but they say, we don't want to hear about it. It's up to Congress. And so what did you say?
Well, I reminded them that, yes, it is up to Congress to investigate, but I'm trying to report these to you, and you have a responsibility to receive it. Now, on one of the cases, which I filed against the National Transportation Safety Board, that's the political board members now, I was trying to get an order to force the NTSB to admit, to receive evidence concerning two particular crashes. One was the PSA San Diego crash. Well, the Assistant U.S. Attorney, George Stoll, S-T-O-L-L, called me on the phone after I filed the action. He admitted, and he was concerned. He said he was recommending to his superiors in Washington that they support my action. Well, they, instead they moved to dismiss it. But anyhow, getting to 9/11 now, well, one of the reasons I filed a lawsuit in New York City, because that's where most of the 3,000 people were killed, in the hijackings. And since, one thing, several things we should remember. One, well, hijackings of four airliners, now that, and what happened thereafter, that's an those are aviation disasters. And the preventive measures for these was with the Federal Aviation Administration. The FBI and the CIA, they're not involved in, intelligence failures, but those are strictly secondary to the corruption that created the conditions that enabled the hijackers to seize the four airliners. So anyhow, here we've had hijackings for 50 years. We knew how easy it was to prevent the aircraft from being taken over by hijackers. I even made reports on it. And so therefore, what I was trying to bring out in the court, I was trying to force them to receive this evidence. But it wasn't only on the aviation deals. It was on the corruption in the FBI and the CIA that also affected 9/11. But the primary problem was within the FAA. But they didn't want to receive it, but and here I'm leaving out a lot.
No, wait a minute. You filed a claim in the courts in New York dealing with what happened on 9/11.
That was part of it.
All right. Did the federal government send lawyers to try to prevent you from doing that?
I'm sorry, we were both talking at the same time.
I'm sorry, but did the federal government send lawyers to try to prevent you from filing those claims?
Oh, yes. Well, a U.S. attorney. Now, remember, this is the U.S. attorney that recently prosecuted Martha Stewart for obstruction of justice. Well, the same U.S. attorney then is obstructing justice by requesting the court to dismiss my action. They said I had no standing to report criminal activity. Well, you know, there are many people in prison for failing to report a particular criminal act that they witnessed. So, at any rate, and here's what happened when I filed the action in the U.S. District Court. For 13 months, they refused to file it. They have to file it the day it's received, but they didn't file it until I sent letters to each of the Supreme Court justices describing to them the latest obstruction of justice by judges over whom they have supervisory responsibility.
Now, this is the United States Supreme Court justices you contacted?
Oh, yes. I've been keeping them aware of these things. But matter of fact, in the early days, when I was being blocked from reporting these matters, I went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and you'll see some of those on my website. But at any rate, then they filed it. But what happened, the same day they filed my complaint, they filed a five-page dismissal order.
Well, how could they do that if they're just filing it?
Well, that's it. Well, that's... there were many, many things they violated, many matters of law. And they had so many things in the five-page dismissal order, it took them weeks to prepare it. So here, weeks before they file my action, my complaint, they're already addressing and preparing a sua sponte dismissal order. But anyhow, so I then filed a notice of appeal. And then I filed the various appeal briefs with the Court of Appeals. And I was surprised, the Court of Appeals in New York then scheduled me for oral argument. And they don't often do that, and especially if you're pro se. Anyhow, I appeared, that was on August 24th, which was not very long ago, And it's really interesting. It's a really sophisticated proceeding, especially in New York. And
now this is a federal court.
Oh, yes.
You are going to appeal. You're going to appear before the federal appeals court in New York. And of course, I suppose then the government's going to send somebody there to saying we don't want to hear any of the information that he has about 911.
Oh yes. Well, after I gave my they only allow you 10 minutes, so you have to just hit the highlights. But they already have the briefs. I presented my argument, and then the Justice Department presented theirs, and so a couple of days later, and then they dismissed it. So now I am preparing what we call a petition for rehearing en banc. That's where all of the judges now have to decide whether they'll hear it or not. Well, the main thing I'm doing here is making a record. Of course, the record doesn't mean a damn thing unless people look at it.
All right.
And the best place to find the record is on the DetroitingAmerica.com website.
All right, fine. Well, now, what are the points that you're trying to bring out as far as 911 is concerned and what we haven't been told about what happened there?
Well, what I'm trying to bring out is, first of all, there's several areas of blame. Now, the 9/11 Commission and Congress, all they've looked into was the secondary areas, the so-called intelligence failures and failures to act on unknown intelligence, which, that's significant. But it's far more important to find out what type of misconduct existed in the offices that are responsible for preventing this. But if they look at that, then they get into all the areas, all the members of Congress that I notified over the years. I even notified members of Congress when a major air disaster was front page news for a week to happen in my immediate area of responsibility. And I still couldn't get anything out of them. And then when I would report the criminal activities in the FBI and the CIA, the drug smuggling, and there was many other things I reported. Never once did they do anything. So all this, I even filed a lawsuit 10 years ago against the certain members of Congress for their obstruction of justice. And I knew I wouldn't prevail, but one thing the record shows, one, they came back and answered, yes, they knew about my allegations. No, they didn't investigate. But they are totally... they have no liability whatsoever as members of Congress. So there's a lot of things that would have come out. Then the things that they did to try to silence me, well, that's quite a story in itself.
Well, they actually sent you to prison at one time, didn't they, to silence you?
Well, one of the things they did to silence me, let's see, in about 1986, I'm starting to hear about corruption from from CIA, FBI sources. This would be October Surprise, drug smuggling, illegal arming and funding of Iraq during the 1980s. And so I'm trying to report these things. Well, what happened? Two federal judges, one Judge Patel in San Francisco and then Judge Milton Schwartz in Sacramento, they issued orders permanently depriving me the right to file any papers in federal, district, or appellate court.
How can they do that?
Well, it's obviously quite unlawful and unconstitutional, and since they knew they were blocking me from reporting the criminal activities, those would be criminal acts because that would be obstruction of justice. But who's going to stop them? Nobody. So, I mean, I brought this up to the U.S. Supreme Court justices numerous times, primarily because the justices have supervisory responsibility over the judges that are involved in obstruction of justice.
And what did the Supreme Court do?
They don't do anything. I did have, only got one letter back, one from a Justice White. It was a personal letter. And what he was saying was more or less that by himself there's nothing he could do.
All that we'll be back in just a moment here with Rodney Stitz, a true crusader for righteousness here in America. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Rodney Stitch, who's been on the front lines of trying to expose the corruption that exists at every level of our society. And, of course, he's mentioning that he'd gotten a letter back from Supreme Court Justice Byron White, who said, yes, I know that there are problems, but there's nothing I can do because I'm all by myself. Is that, in essence, what he said?
Yes, and I even have a copy of that letter on my website somewhere. But this is... Here's what, if this information came out, let's say if people would address, hey, who is primarily responsible for the hijacking aircraft? And that's, of course, in the FAA. But if they go into that, they get into all these other areas. And then, of course, as I mentioned a minute ago about the orders permanently barring me access to the federal courts, well, what happened then? Later on, I'm finding out other areas corruption. Gunther Rusbacher was one of my main initial CIA sources, and he was giving me information like on October Surprise, the drug smuggling, and anyhow. So I figured, well, I've got to report this, and Congress won't do anything. So I filed another action. So that what they did, they charged me with. Would you believe this? Criminal contempt of court for attempting to report these criminal activities, some of which had fatal consequences. And so these are the type of things which would come out. And, of course, what they were doing, they were blocking me from exposing the corruption that created the conditions that made 9/11 possible. So now we're getting into pretty serious areas.
All right.
You know, I've been at this so long, I don't find it troublesome anymore.
Well, Rodney, for our listeners out there, well, you can go to Rodney's website, defraudingamerica.com. That's defraudingamerica.com, fascinating website. Now, we do carry Rodney's book, Defrauding America, and we carry his book, Drugging America, and his book on Unfriendly Skies, and about United Airlines. And all of these books are must-reading, tremendous amount of information, them well-documented. From people, whistleblowers have come to Rodney because they're afraid to come forward on their own. And Rodney had the courage to write this up, put it in book form, and get the truth out there. Rodney, has anybody come to you since 9/11 to give you any information on what really happened that morning?
Well, the information we're hearing? I mean, I'm an expert in this area. I don't need someone else to tell me what the problems that were in the FAA. I'll tell them, but they're going to tell me. So that's where the main problems are.
All right. Well, I thought there might have been somebody who was involved in the cover-up who had advanced knowledge, and they might have, you know, they're just afraid to come forward and say what they know. I know some of the people in the FBI went to my friend Dr. Garth Nicholson and told him about the attack, told him the date of the attack. I told him it was going to involve the Pentagon. Dr. Nicholson then went to high government officials. But needless to say, he was never called to testify before the 9/11 attack. Same one happened to David Shippers. We've interviewed him. He was told that there was going to be an attack on Lower Manhattan. They didn't mention what it was, but it was going to come the end of August or the first part of September. And, of course, he went to Washington, D.C., tried to talk to people who knew in government. This had actually been the counsel for the impeachment hearings that were there, and nobody would talk to him. So, obviously, a lot of people knew the attack was coming. And, of course, that's the information we need to get ahead of time, because when the government says, oh, we had no idea it was coming, they're quite frankly lying.
Well, they had for several years.
Oh, that's just funny. Okay, fine. I guess this evening, Rodney Stitch. And Rodney, go ahead. Rodney was beginning to say that for several years they'd had what now?
Well, as anybody who's been reading the various sources knows that for several years the government personnel knew that Al-Qaeda was planning on hijacking aircraft. And if we had a competent FAA administrator... But we haven't had a competent FAA administrator in decades. What we do, we appoint someone that's politically correct. It gets votes. So eventually you'll pay for it. But a competent FAA administrator, if they had not thought about how to prevent hijackings before, the moment they heard about Al-Qaeda planning on hijacking aircraft, within 24 hours, they could have done the two primary things that would have blocked the hijacking. And, you know, they got in that those cockpits. They didn't have to break down any doors, not from the evidence that exists. All they had to do was go to the flight attendant and take the key from the flight attendant. And that's one of the things I reported as an FAA inspector, that no flight attendant should have a key to the cockpit. So anyhow, that's how they, if they had entered the order, if the FAA had entered the order, in 24 hours the keys could have all been gone out of the cabin, and probably there would be no hijackings, 3,000 people would not be killed. But nobody seems to understand these things.
And you'd actually put that in as a recommendation when you were one of the chief FAA inspectors, is that right?
Oh, I made many recommendations because, I mean, when you are there, first of all, I had been an airline captain for many years. Prior to that, in World War II, I was a Navy patrol plane commander and a flight instructor. So with all this experience, you have to be pretty dumb not to know how easy it was to prevent hijacking.
Okay, so the things that you want to do would be to take the keys away from the flight attendants. What else would you do?
Well, the keys away from the flight attendants, that would be primary, initial, and then make the cockpit doors stronger, though there's no evidence of anybody ever breaking a cockpit door down, so it's possible. But the main thing is get the keys away from the flight attendants. And then there were some other things for long term that could have been done. Of course, the security, it was obvious, some of the security problems we had then, and which we have now also. So, but the FAA culture does not respond to safety problems. Even like in my program, there was a series of air disasters, all caused by safety problems and even safety violations that I and other inspectors knew to exist. But what happened, we're told, don't make reports. It makes us look bad when there's a crash. Of course, our job is to prevent the crash. But no, their interest is that we don't want to have the blame on us. And then you do make reports, they're destroyed. That's a felony. And then if there's a fatality, then that becomes even worse. And then those of us who made reports, we suffered retaliation. Now, none of this ever comes out because it gets a little nasty when you have so many people scattered around an airport or wherever the crash occurs.
All right, fine. Now, what about, how do you feel about having marshals on the planes, having the pilots armed? Wouldn't both of those things have been the logical thing to have done when they knew that they were planning to hijack the planes?
Well, I'm in favor of pilots being armed. Now, as far as sky marshals, now that's a mixed bag. You know, if you can have a sky, first of all, if there's a shooting match going on back there, I'm not exactly too pleased about that. And on some of the sky marshals, who knows whether some of the sky marshals they hired were found to have criminal records. So, but anyhow, the main thing was if they can't get into the cockpit, you pretty well have the situation under control.
All right, and so the simplest thing to do would be just to take the keys away from the stewardesses, and of course, but then of course the pilots have to come out occasionally to go to the bathroom, so then they're going to have to unlock the doors.
Well, I also mentioned that the pilots coming out of the cockpit should be a very, very minimum, because any time they come out, there's the risk of if there's a hijacker on board.
All right, fine. We're going to be back in just a moment with Rodney Stitch. And, of course, we're going to welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Rodney was a flight inspector for many years working for the FAA, saw the corruption that was going on there, tried to report it, blocked at every turn. And, well, he's been working for 20 or 30 years now trying to get the truth out. So give us a call, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Rodney Stitch, and Rodney certainly has written a number of excellent books, because, of course, the corruption is at every level of government. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So said Lord Acton, and anybody who knows anything about government knows that government, by its very essence, is corruption. And I wish it were different, but unfortunately, whenever you give men power and advantage for being corrupt, why, they will be corrupt, because there is evil that certainly does lurk in the hearts of men. Now, we have a lot of good people and working for government, I'm sure, but unfortunately, it seems that the most corrupt usually get to the top. If they're not corrupt, then they're going to be gotten out of office, and they're going to bring in somebody else who will certainly give favors or certainly turn his back on corruption. They know. We see what's going on at Los Alamos today. We see what's going on in the FAA, in the Federal Drug Administration, where they authorize drugs, and then the very people who have authorized the drugs suddenly leave government and go to work for the drug companies that they've been regulating, and this happens at every level of our government. In fact, Professor Quigley, in his analysis of how the people control our government, on page 324 of his classic book, Tragedy and Hope, comments that, you know, what they do, these people of great wealth, they hire the government officials and give them a comfortable salary once they've left government service. So this is what how the government really works. And what you have to do is limit the power of government so they can't do these things and, of course, misuse their power and authority. So, Rodney, now, as far as your reporting on the 911 and this recent filing you have in the city of New York, were there any other suggestions that you made that might have warded off the 911 attack besides taking the keys away from the stewardesses?
Well, some of the other things I tried to bring out, and that's also on some of the books I've written, was the corruption in the FBI and the CIA. And when you have this type of corruption, it, of course, is going to affect their intelligence gathering information and also their response to intelligence. So that would be among the areas of corruption. In other words, what I was looking for is for the court to allow me and several other former government agents to testify and present evidence.
And there were really other agents who were willing to come with you and testify.
Well, yes, and this would include former FBI agents, former CIA agents, and others. And, of course, they won't dare allow that. First of all, the judges are now complicit on these. And when I say complicit, I mean criminally
complicit.
Hold
that thought right there, Rodney. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, Rodney is saying that what he is trying to do is get a hearing. He has ex-FBI agents, ex-government officials from many points who will come and testify with him about the corruption in government. And, of course, the Attorney General, the representatives of the Attorney General can't allow this to happen. And so they block these efforts. And, of course, he files them, and they actually have to have a court hearing. And then the representatives of the government will be there giving all the reasons why they don't want to hold a hearing and get the truth out. Would that be a fair statement, Rodney?
Oh, yes. And it's so surprising, though. Here, again, going back to the U.S. attorney in New York City, here I'm bringing out, here I am, a former key Federal Aviation Safety agent, and I'm trying to report the criminal activities, crimes against the United States, and the U.S. attorney is blocking me. That's obstruction of justice. And with a long line of fatal airline crashes, and that's only one of the areas. Remember, the drug smuggling by the CIA, that has many, many victims there. The, of course, 9/11, was primarily due to the problems in the aviation offices. And there's different areas. And we are also trying to expose some of the corruption that's, related to the, unlawful and the COVID funding of Iraq, the providing Iraq with military equipment, the so-called weapons of mass destruction, and all of this was going on during the 1980s. Now, I write about that and defrauding America. But there's another book I have, but this is only available on the Internet and for easy downloading, and that's called blowback, 9/11, Iraq lies and cover-ups. And that has a lot of highly sensitive material in related to both Iraq and 9/11. Also, American Airlines Flight 587.
That 587, was that the one that went down about a month or so after 9/11?
Right, 2 months afterwards, and there's sufficient evidence of an explosion on the flight near the tail, and some very fairly sophisticated people in Queens saw the explosion. I'm talking about retired firemen, retired policemen who have seen it. And then there's also a report that Al-Qaeda is claiming responsibility for placing a bomb on board that aircraft. And this was in a list of terrorist acts that they claim they're responsible for. And then there's some additional information from other former Al-Qaeda terrorists who further support that a particular Al-Qaeda terrorist got on board the plane with explosives, and it was a suicide bombing. Any terrorist can wrap himself up in explosives and get on board a plane because there's no check for that.
All right, well, let's go to Matt, who's got a quick question here. Matt, did you have another question for our guest this evening?
Yeah, actually, I have three.
Oh, well, let's just take one at a time.
Oh, okay. Yes, I was wondering if you're aware of a statutory provision for a class action, a breach of the public trust lawsuit, and that would be the primary question.
Well, I agree. The primary question the man is asking, are you aware of the statutory provision for a lawsuit for breach of the public trust? And that's really what you've been doing for 20 years, isn't it, Rodney?
Yes, well, I believe the caller, though, meant a class action.
Gotten
into all the intricacies of a class action. But look at Title 18 U.S.C. Section 4. Any individual can file that. And I'm surprised more people haven't done it.
Okay, I'd like to also say that Bernie Sanders, the independent congressman from either Vermont or New Hampshire, I saw in an interview on Free Speech TV, and he said that the American taxpayers actually own the airwaves, and he strongly, ardently recommended that people who love liberty and freedom need to organize and establish local-based radio stations for this very purpose.
I know, but the trouble is, of course, that they come after you. Maybe you've got the right on your side, but when the FEC sends in a SWAT team and seizes everything you've got, who are you going to appeal to? The government?
Yeah, you have a point.
Okay, anything else? Have a third point you want to make.
Yeah, the last question, Rodney, I had heard somewhere that, I think it was Daniel Hopsicker in a book called Welcome to Terrorland, that there were military jets on maneuver the morning of 9/11, and apparently when there's hijackings, there's escalating alerts that go out to the military jets, and they were all told to stand down, I guess it was for an hour and a half. You heard anything about that?
The information I have was there was a certain amount of delay in getting them up there. But, you know, let's say even if they had gotten up there, this one of the things that disturbs me is this talk about shooting down an airliner with several hundred people on board on the possibility that it has been hijacked. Maybe it was hijacked, but that doesn't mean it's going to be rammed into a building. But we're willing to kill several hundred people. I'm certainly against that.
Right.
But at any rate, that doesn't exactly answer your question, but that's
Matt,
the best I can do.
Matt, there's a great deal of evidence that's covered in Jim Maher's book, It's called Inside Job. It's covered in Peter Lance's book, which will be coming out within the next 2 weeks, called Cover Up. Yes, you're absolutely right. There were military maneuvers that morning. And what it did was just confuse the issue. There were planes in the air that morning. But, of course, they were never called in to protect America. In fact, one of the exercises that morning was theoretically a plane supposedly was going to crash into the headquarters of NORAD in the Northeast. Now, when this is what the make-believe war game that was going on, and when Condoleezza Rice says, who would ever thought anybody would hijack a plane and fly it into a building, Condoleezza Rice was lying to cover something. So thanks so much for calling, but you're absolutely right.
Thank you, Doctor.
Bye-bye. Okay, in fact, I think this is an important issue, that there really were war games that morning, and as I say, covered in several books, authoritative books that have been very, very carefully researched. There were, of course, missile batteries all around the Pentagon and all around Washington, D.C. Now, they knew the plane was coming in, and the question is, why weren't those missile batteries firing at the plane that was coming in? They knew which plane it was. All the planes had been grounded at that time. Here's this plane barreling in towards the Pentagon. I don't know what happened, whether the plane hit the Pentagon or something else hit the Pentagon. But we do know that they could have brought the fighter planes in. They did not. They sent them out over the Atlantic Ocean. They were only 105 miles away at Langley. They were actually 10 miles away at Andrews Air Force Base. Instead of sending the planes from Andrews 10 miles away, they sent them in from Langley, and then they sent them out over the Atlantic Ocean. Now, Langley was 105 miles away from Washington, D.C. At the time of the attack, they were 150 miles away from Washington, D.C. How could that have happened? Unintentionally. So I'm sure you have much more information than I do, Rodney. Would you like to comment on that?
Well, I'm not. From what I read, I haven't, official reports, I haven't seen anything on that yet, though it may have existed. But I'm focusing on primary blame, not on some of these peripheral matters.
All right, fine. Well, I think that's important. I think it would have been so easy to have prevented this if they'd wanted to prevent it. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. If you have a question, a comment, you agree or you disagree. I mean, do you believe the official government line? I'll tell you about the recent Zogby poll in New York City showed that 50% of the people do not believe what the government says. What about out across America? Do you believe the official party line that's put out, that we had no idea the attack was coming, that we had no way we could have stopped it, and of course that nobody's responsible, it was just the system, it was the process that was responsible. Certainly no individual had anything they could have done any differently, and you don't really believe that at all, do you, Rodney?
Well, Stan, this, I was in the Navy a year before Pearl Harbor. And, you know, that was a screw-up if ever there was one. Well, this is the culture in the United States. Only thing is now, besides never responding to anything, the various government offices are filled with corrupt people. So we have a worse situation now, but it's not going to change. Look at all the people who support, who believe all of the lies about Iraq. When you've got that many people believing those lies, what chance does someone, does a government insider have to try and blow the whistle? You don't have any chance.
Well, of course, it is because of the degree of control of the media. It is because there are about six major corporations that control 95% of our major media. And because of that, the American people never hear the other side. And they honestly think they're getting the truth from Rush Limbaugh or Bill O'Reilly. They think they're conservatives. No, they're the fighters conservatives that money could buy. But they're not telling the people the truth. They're not paid to reveal the truth. They're paid to conceal the truth.
And, you know, the gravity of this, the complicity, when you cover up for lies that have such awesome consequences, you're complicit in the crimes. And this is what I'm aghast at, is that there isn't hardly anyone speaking out about this.
Well, of course, we are speaking out against this, you know, 5 hours a day. And I do believe that there is a growing number of people out in America who know something's wrong. Now, a lot of these people are ardent Kerry supporters. I think that Michael Moore is obviously a Kerry supporter, and his film 911, Fahrenheit 911, is aimed at getting Kerry elected. I can't stand Kerry, but I can't stand the people in the Bush administration either, so I don't take any sides. I think they're all corrupt. But I do think that Michael Moore's film probably at least got some people thinking. And I think the new film by Dave Von Kleiss that goes into the 911 attack called In Plain Sight. That's P-L-A-I-N Sight, not P-L-A-N-E Sight, and S-I-T-E. I think that all of these are getting people thinking. I think there are more people thinking today than really we've had in a long period of time, Rodney. I know it seems may seem very discouraging to you, but I'm more encouraged than I've ever been, because at least through the Internet and through alternative radio, some people are beginning to question what they're told by the controlled media.
Well, you know, when I first started getting on radio about 3,000 shows back, that was back in 1978, when I was coming out with information about corruption in the FAA, people couldn't hardly believe it. And this is like with the NTSB, how they covered up for the missile attack on TWA Flight 800, and how they covered up for the evidence of the bomb on 587, American Airlines 587. The average person can't believe, and I can see that, the lying would come out like this. Probably I might have been that naive before I joined the federal government and found out just how corrupt we have it today.
Well, I think that what we have to do is get morality back into government. I think that what we're seeing, the atrocities committed at the Abu Ghraib prison, one of the generals, there were two generals who were doing this, evaluation of what happened, and one of them made that amazing statement. He said, you know, there's something morally wrong with these people who committed these atrocities, as if that's something new. Of course there's something morally wrong. We've taken God out of our schools and prayer out of our schools and moral values out of our schools, and everything is moral moral relativism, and a general comes up with the amazing comment, why, you know, there's something morally wrong. They've lost their moral concepts. Well, we've taken away any concepts of moral absolutes from our people. Should we be surprised that our young people would commit atrocities like this? And I'm surprised that more of them did not. I'm surprised that there are so many people who realize there is something wrong with what happened. And I think that shows that there's inherent goodness in our people. Well, Matt's back one time again. Matt, did you have another question?
Yes, Dr. Stan, please. I was made aware of the effort of the...
Speak up just a little louder, please.
Sure. There's an effort, Rodney, on the Pilots Association to be armed with handguns. Well, I know of a device that's been actually endorsed by the ATF and FBI. It's called the Myotron or Black Widow. It disrupts the autonomic nervous system so that the most egregious attacker, even on drugs, is put down really quick. And it's not a stun gun. And the guy that's the inventor out of Florida offered to the Justice Department to arm the whole entire industry, pilots and crew, and the Justice Department told the guy to go fly a kite.
Well, basically, how does this work? How does it get the autonomic nervous system? Is with it some sort of a chemical, or is it an electrical charge, or what?
Yes, Dr. Stan, it's an electronic device, and it goes through 2 inches of clothing. It takes about half a second, and it disrupts the voluntary muscle system.
All right, fine.
And it's totally effective. They tested it on very egregious attackers. FBI, ATF says, great, it's not a stun gun, it's not a weapon, it's totally self-defense. And I thought maybe Rodney might be, you know...
Never heard of it.
All right, fine. I know there are things that, of that sort. I didn't know that you could put them in again, but I've talked to people who've actually been in a situation, feigned military situations, where they've actually, been crawling up on what they thought was a make-believe target, and suddenly were totally paralyzed. I talked to a man with a special forces unit that experimented on him. So there are units of that sort. But I'll tell you what, Matt, if this would really work, you can be sure one thing, and that is they're not going to use it.
Yeah.
Any more than they're going to give our boys decent guns. You know, with the people over there in Iraq trying to get their hands on the Russian guns because ours jam all the time, how with all the money we're spending, could you come up with guns that are so inadequate unintentionally?
Thanks so much. Well, Dr. Stan, I'm starting to do my own campaign. Rodney tonight and many of your other guests have just motivated me to the max. And I'm at the very least going to organize a listening club in my locale, and hopefully it'll take off from there.
Okay, fine. Well, I hope you get them listening to us. Bye-bye and good night, Matt. Okay, fine. Well, I will be back here in just a moment with Rodney to finish up on this evening's program here at Radio Liberty, and we have time for one more call if you're out there in the listening audience at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But you can set up listening clubs like Matt is doing. Get people to listen. Of course, make sure they're listening to good programs where the information is going to be legitimate, because believe me, there are all sorts of plans out there and programs that are putting out frankly fraudulent information, disinformation intensely, to overload you with facts that just aren't true at all. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Rodney Stitch. And, of course, Rodney, Matt was talking about this special type of some sort of a gun that paralyzes people. And I'm sure that we have these things. How do you feel about the use of stun guns rather than the pistols?
If I'm in the cockpit, I'd rather have a pistol than a stun gun. I know it'll be effective. I don't know how effective the stun gun would be. You know, when I flew in the Middle East, and I was a pilot in the Middle East, flying out of Baghdad and Jeddah and many of those places over there, and I carried a pistol with me at the time. Things were very informal over there, but we didn't get shot at. We didn't get shot down when we flew over different countries, but I had it just in case. But at that time, the Arabs were very friendly toward us.
And I think that really most of the Arabs really are friendly. What we're doing is our foreign policy is designed specifically to antagonize the Arabs and turn them against us, just as so much of the propaganda we're seeing here in America is designed to turn us against the Arabs. If you don't create hatreds, how are you going to get a war going? And
you know,
the more nobody came, how would you get people killing one another? And then the more they kill, the more they want to kill. And I think that we could live in peace with the Arabs. We may disagree with some of their beliefs, but we could live in peace with the Arabs. But I think that there are people who want more wars with Iran and Syria. And I believe that our troops are not coming home anytime soon at all. What are your thoughts, Rodney?
Well, I think it's a disaster, just as many people warned before we even started the invasion of Iraq. And I mean we have generated
Thank you.